Well, hey there. Welcome to The Real Podcast. We share the stories and insights of real people that challenge your mind and inspire you to grow. For more information and resources, check out our website at CochraneAlliance.com/real. So, let's get real.
Well, here we go. Welcome to the inaugural episode of The Real Podcast. My name is Jason Kaliba, and I hope that there's more than three people, my wife and my mother-in-law, that are listening to what we're doing right now. Real was birthed in my mind sometime last year, in 2018, and in my day job as a pastor, I come into contact with a lot of different people. And there was something my dad said to me. He was is in the same line of work that I am as a pastor. And he said to me when I was a kid once, people are interesting. And as I have grown up and come into contact with lots of people, I totally agree with that, that the more you get to know people, the more you dive into their stories, everybody is interesting. Everybody's life experience is valuable and unique. And I felt like when I speak on the platform on Sunday mornings, we've done a lot of interviews over the years, and I always wish I had more time and more space to be able to talk to more people to hear their interesting stories. So why not, with this mode of podcasting, use the platform as a way to hear more stories and learn about more interesting people? So we're going to try a few test episodes here to see if others find people as interesting as I do, and not just for the sake of talking, but to scratch beneath the surface in the stories of human beings' lives and to find out what drives them, what inspires them, and maybe see if we can find some motivation and inspiration for our own journeys. So here we go with round one, and I want to welcome to the Real Studio my friend of over 20 years, Gwyn Butler. Gwyn, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a privilege, and thanks for being our guinea pig on this. I hope that you don't walk away scarred.
Well, I'm honored that you asked me as the inaugural guest.
Well, we'll both see when we listen to it whether we like the sound of our own voices as much as we like speaking. Gwyn, I've known you for, I think, I was thinking back on it, 20 years now, and kind of watched your journey unfold. I probably came into it on the front half of it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And as we were talking, getting ready for this recording, I found you to be one of the most inspiring people that I know. And I know that you're not a person who, likes to be in the spotlight, but I hope that in our conversation today that story can come out a little bit.
Wow, well, I hardly think I'm inspiring to myself, let alone others.
Gwyn, one of the aspects of your life that is unique, and it's a painful side, is the fact that you're single, but you haven't always been. And when I first met you, you were connected with your husband, Rick. Mm-hmm. So maybe can you back us up and tell us a little bit about your life, and especially your marriage to Rick and your daughters? Just give us a few minutes on kind of your life up until the point which we're going to dive into a little later.
Well, Rick was the love of my life. We had a beautiful love story. Mm. We met in high school. We knew each other in high school. We operated in different circles, so we never really met. Then when I went to university, lo and behold, there's Rick in the same degree program I'm in, recreation administration, which was this kind of novel, up-and-coming area, a fusing of community development and phys ed. And so I brushed shoulders with Rick on and off, but I actually knew his best friend better than my Rick. his name was also Rick. So it was like the Rick and Rick show when those two were together. So it was really cool because in many ways, I feel Rick was custom made for me. You know, he was designed for me. We met in a very magical way. We were walking between classes at university, and I'll never forget the moment. This was the defining moment when I knew this was a guy I wanted to pay attention to. Huh. And he was walking the opposite direction to me. It was in winter, and he slipped on a patch of ice. Just as our eyes locked, he slipped, but he didn't fall. He just kind of went, whoa, you know, arms in the air flailing around. And we both just roared laughing at each other. Just the moment was the breaking point of sort of engaging. Mm. Anyways, he asked me out to grad out of the blue, and I had to decline. And I said, I'm so sorry. I've already asked someone else to take me to grad, because I was free at that time. I didn't have a relationship. And so he honored that, and he said that was one of the things he liked about me, was that I had respected the commitment I'd made already to somebody else. And he didn't stop there. He asked me out again. So there He's the persistent. Love story began. And we had a life of adventure, I would say. Right from the get-go, we knew we both wanted to explore frontiers. So we moved up to the Arctic as our first place together as a married couple. Mm. And we spent a good 15 years in Canada's Arctic, and traversing right from Iqaluit to Whitehorse.
And investing in communities and people, that's kind of always been a part of your journey together and yours alone as well.
Definitely. And the fact that we both had the same passion for communities, we were sort of at the ground level on developing some of the early awareness in those communities towards health and wellness and recreation. And Rick moved more into governance and municipal development, whereas I kind of stuck in the more nonprofit sector, helping youth and what else? The marginalized people, really, you know, is I worked with physically disabled people, and that term we would say they were persons of disability.
Okay.
But anyways, it was just every move we made, there was always a sense of excitement and adventure, and it was driven really largely by Rick. He had this overwhelming energy and passion for work and for impacting communities and people. One of the things I can say about him quite freely is that I don't think he had a single enemy. Mm. Everyone just loved him because he came into people's lives and in the work world or in our personal lives, and he just had this way of entering in and just not with gusto, but just gently, but with presence, and people respected him.
Mm. And you had a couple girls along the way?
Yes, we did. About 10 years after we were married. So we made a conscious decision not to have children right away. Mm. We did our adventuring, traveled a bit. And then we decided after the travel, that was a time where we needed to hunker down.
Yep.
Settle down a bit and have children. And so we had two wonderful girls about 18 months apart. So it was bang, bang. And we... I'm glad we had children really close together, because they are now really good friends.
Cool.
Plus, we were a little later in life. I was 35, I think, when I had my first daughter. So there wasn't a lot of time to waste. But anyways, we had a wonderful time. He was such a good dad, Rick. And he just embraced being a father so beautifully. Mm. And we just had an adventure, even raising our kids. Everything was kind of fun, you know. Mm. We had lots of fun.
That sounds like the Rick I know.
Yeah.
Eventually, that resulted in you coming into the Cochrane area with Rick getting involved with the Stoney First Nations.
Yes.
And then in the Calgary Regional Partnership, and then eventually with Rocky View County. So, and the establishment of your, your ranch just a little bit south of Cochrane. And let me skip ahead, which I know we could probably spend an hour just talking. But let's skip ahead to 2011. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the day that things changed for you?
Well, it was Boxing Day. We just had Christmas with the family. It's hard to talk about this. It's interesting. As you asked these questions earlier, I just thought this is the one question I'm not going to put anything down in my head because I know it'll just come out the way it's supposed to. Rick had this thing. He loved to go skiing.
I know he often invited me. I didn't ever get a chance to ski with him, but he often invited me.
And it was a tradition to go skiing on Boxing Day. And the girls loved skiing too. And I had sort of backed off of skiing a bit, mostly because it was, I enjoyed it, but I just couldn't kind of keep up with the pace. And I was a slower skier and I just liked to meander down the hill. So I always felt like I was too slow. And so I just said, no, you guys go have your day. So Rick went off with both of my daughters, Corey and Marnie, and Marnie's now husband, Kevin, and his brother, Al. And they all headed off and had a great day, and I had a luxurious kind of relaxing day to myself post-Christmas. And then I get a phone call from my daughter, Marnie, on the ski hill. She's phoned me from the hill and said, Mom, there's been an accident. And she, I could tell in her voice it was wavering a bit. And I said, okay, what's happening? She said, well, Dad has slipped on the ice and he's hit a tree. And he's okay. He's talking. But we're taking him down to the bottom of the hill. And so what happened was he was just a freak accident, right? He hit a patch of ice. Everyone was on the hill with him. He's the one that hit the ice. And he went into the trees and hit the tree. Everything appeared okay. I mean, when on the phone call, it was like, oh, okay, my first thought is head injury, neck injury, broken leg. I said, oh, did he break a leg?
Yeah.
You know, was my first kind of off-the-cuff comment to my daughter. And she said, no, it's but it's okay. Someone's here and we're taking him down. And so, you know, they kept me in touch. But then the next phone call is, Mom, they're taking him to the hospital by ambulance. You better go there. But don't go by yourself. And I said, no, of course I'll go by myself. I'm fine. So I, stubborn me, went by myself. And I'm at the hospital waiting and waiting and waiting and nothing. And I was probably there for 45 minutes and I'm going, what's going on? You know, he should be here by now. And then I see him come in. And he looks like he's resting. Everything's fine. And so I call, even as they wheel him through the corridor. I just said, Rick, I'm here. And the look that the attendant gave me, the first aid guy, was like he looked over at me with a startled look in his eye. Like, oh. But anyways, I just kind of brushed that off. Then my girls arrive and my two best friends, Lori and Sarah, they were there with me. And we waited and waited, and I'm going, this is either good or bad, but I'm staying positive. It's okay. Everything's fine. I'm praying, constantly praying. Yeah. And then we're ushered into a room, and I'm going, oh, the room. I don't know if this is good. But I, again, tried to stay positive. Went into the room, we waited, and then the doctors come in, and they say, I'm sorry, I have to tell you that he passed away. And it was like a brick hit you. It's just, you get knocked over. That's not what I was expecting. I was expecting, oh, he's paralyzed or something, but not that.
That he's gone.
So there was no preparation for that. But my instant reaction in that moment is, oh, my goodness, we got to pray. We got to pray. So I just prayed out loud, and the doctors were in the room, and everyone was there, and I just said, you know, Lord, I don't understand this, but I know you're in control of this situation, and I just give it to you. And so we just debriefed as a family, and we were definitely in shock. and come home, and it's like, what is the next step with now? What do we do now? Well, we have to phone the family, and so we started there. Phone one or two people that then fanned it out to the rest. So that was one of the strategies I think that someone was suggesting was, don't you make every phone call. You're not in a position to make these phone calls. So you make the most important ones. You find one member in the family that you can inform. They can inform the rest of the family. So that was a help. It was a huge help. And then it's just the days rolled after and that. It was like, it was out of your control. It's now the wheels are in motion. And now you have to start thinking about what the next phase and steps are about a memorial service. This is the holiday season. It's Boxing Day. The next person I call, there's one, two, and three on the list. It was my mom and dad, Rick's sister, who I knew would be able to handle the news and do a great job of reaching everyone. My parents fanned out. And then you, Jason, you were my number three. I knew that you were officiating at a wedding, so I waited and waited until I think the next day, and I said, I can't interrupt this wedding. I can't interrupt Jason's time. So that was okay. I needed that time anyways at home with family. And so you were my call, and I just remember being so relieved that I had you on my side, you know, that you were there for me. And so when we talk about the importance of the who are the most important people in your life at a time like this, you've got to have your team. So I had a team. I had family members who stepped in, and one or two real key family members, and a couple of really good friends. And that's all that you need. You don't need a whole host of people. You need one or two really good people close to you that can help you make decisions. And my daughters were amazing as well.
Yeah, I remember them really stepping. And yeah, especially after they were right there for it. They were strong in that season after walking through something like that. I still remember their strength.
And they had a lot more in a way to cope with because they were with him. For the accident. So they have different memories and different things that they're processing around that.
So there's the flurry of activities, obviously with moving to a service and making the adjustments. After maybe let's go to, it's mid-January now, the initial rush is there. What were some of the biggest adjustments you had to make after now Rick's gone? What was the biggest realities that started to hit you?
Well, I'd say that the first couple of weeks is when you've got everyone stepping into your life because they are rallying around you. The memorial service was huge, you know, just planning it, inviting and timing, and then the deluge of people that showed up at my door, and the wonderful expressions of love and concern, the cards, the flowers, the meals, neighbors popping over. You just saw, I just loved, in a way, seeing that appear when I was typically the one that would be the one showing up at the door. I wasn't the recipient. Now I had to sort of accept and receive all this. And so in a way, it was a switch in my head that I had to be more gracious about this. I had to say, yes, come, because I would have been one of those people coming. So it was really weird being on the other end of the receiving end.
I often hear from people that it's way more comfortable to be the person encouraging, making a meal, writing a card. And that being the one that has to like take that stuff, it feels like I should be the one giving. Who am I to be in this place?
Yeah. And I think the other thing that complicated or maybe accentuated it was, Rick was a public person, and it was in the holidays, and so there were a number of factors. It was like front page news. It probably wouldn't have been front page news any other time, but it was kind of like this dead zone of news, and so it kind of hit in a big way on the news, and so it kind of catapulted the family into responding to the news. And so my eldest daughter, Corey, she studied communication, so this is her field. Mm. And she kind of took the bull by the horns and said, "Mom, this is what we have to do." And so it was, how do we respond to the interviews and the news inquiries? What do we say? And what is the messaging? And my daughter's all over that, right? Mm. So she became a bit of a spokesperson. Between the two of us, we were able to handle that together. So I was really thankful for that.
Well, that's something most of us will never have to have to face, the added element of of people wanting to know more and news stories.
Yeah, and then I think the complication too, like I said, of the holidays, of when is a good time to have a memorial service, and I think we picked early January, you mm-hmm. know, when people were getting back. Mm-hmm. So, there was a lot involved just in that, just planning that day.
Okay. So once that initial flurry of activity passed away and you get back to normal life, so to speak, what were the things that were noticeably different, or is it a slow process of adjustment and things kind of evolve over time?
Well, definitely time is your friend. You know, you have to give it time and patience. But in our case, the two girls were at university. They had to basically go back to class the next week. Mm-hmm. So there was no time to sort of have downtime or escape time or anything like that. It was back to life as normal. Mm-hmm. I delved right back into work. So within a week of, 2 weeks of Rick's death, I was at work. I was working. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it was good. In some ways, it kept my mind moving forward. Mm-hmm. Just keep going. Rick's just on holidays. He's coming back. You know, like your mind almost gets into that mode where it's temporary. It hasn't really hit you, the reality of it all. Mm. But what I noticed in the first 2 years after Rick's passing was, and the best description I was given on it that really made sense to me was, I have PTSD. And it was, I noticed it when I couldn't handle certain things. I could only handle maybe two or three multitasking actions, and then I'd break down. I wasn't able to handle stress very easily. So anytime something came up, I would be flying off the handle quite quickly. And so I knew that that wasn't typically me. And there's a brain adjustment. There's something that happens physiologically when you go through shock and then this kind of an adjustment. I'd never really experienced it quite like this before. So it took 2 years.
Wow.
I think for that to really subside and a sense of new normal come back into my life. Wow. And in those 2 years, so much happens, right? I mean, you're processing, I would say, I haven't even gotten to grief yet. This isn't grief. Mm. This is just handling life and people, the people in your life. So for me, I think I jumped into, and maybe it was part of my personality, and part of it was a coping thing, was I'm more protecting others, not myself, right? I'm thinking about others. What are they experiencing in this moment? What are Rick's family and his siblings feeling? What are my girls feeling? I'm not thinking about what am I feeling. So I think after about 2 years, I start delving into what am I feeling.
Okay. And so how did you do that? Like, was it in the company of certain friends, or was it more individual? You're writing things down. How did you?
I couldn't write. You know, I'm a writer. Hmm. And this was a really weird result of part of my processing was I could not write this. I felt it was so fast moving in me. I couldn't capture it, and I didn't want to capture it because I felt it was in motion. Hmm. And I thought the more I write about this, the worse it's going to be for me. Not going to be better. So I think for me, yes, having one or two really trusted friends that you can talk to. I just leaned on Jesus. He was my mainstay. Mm. Without that.
Times of, like, did you go for a drive and just pray, or?
I would be in conversation with God for hours. in the wee hours of the morning. From about 2 o'clock until 5 o'clock was my nighttime conversation with God. Mm. And it would be about everything, just everything, you know, just talking to him. And I never, ever asked God why. Mm. I never, ever asked, like, you know, why Rick, why me, why this time? I just trusted that he was in it. He was in it all. Mm. So, yeah, my faith was really grounded in this time. Having friends who you could debrief with was awesome as well. I have a sister that just totally came alongside me, and she was my confidant, and some really great friends. But I generally kept most of it to myself. I think my conversations were with Rick. Mm. I would talk to him, you know, like he was in the room still, mm-hmm. and I could feel him in the room. That was the weird thing. For 2 or 3 years afterwards, even up until now, I can still feel his presence. Mm. So, I mean, I would talk to him, and I know that doesn't sound kind of mentally healthy, but it was more my just chance to sort of get it off my chest. I'm just telling you now because I know you can't answer me. But it's a one-way conversation here.
Yep.
So I would sort of rant and rave a little bit. You know, I went through anger. I went through a feeling of abandonment, of hurt, and all those stages of grief. But my grief, I think, was very private. When people would see me, I think I almost had this Jekyll and Hyde response. Mm-hmm. And I think the personal me in my quiet hours of the morning when it's just me and my grief, I could just pour it out, right? But when I'm in my public space, when I'm with other people, almost like a steeliness, a crustiness came over me, a matter-of-factness. It's like, yep, that happened. Mm. You know, it's almost like, get on with life. I've got that under control. So I think, I don't know, I'm still processing my personality response to this because I think there's one side of me that was really strong and appeared strong to others, and there's another part that was obviously very weak and vulnerable and just tender, you know, because it was grief at its worst.
And you're a person who's a leader and trained to think about others and help others. And so that's coming out even as maybe you're the person who's needing the help. You're still in default mode, and that's thinking about others first.
Yeah, it's a very weird place to be because you're not just thinking of yourself. It's always about others, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just about, this isn't just about me. And every time I would go into grief in that way, saying, oh, woe is me, it's like, no, not woe is you. Aren't you fortunate? Mm. So I think my default in my thinking has always been how lucky I am, how fortunate I was to have Rick in my life and to have so many blessings and all these wonderful people that stepped up and look at all you've got so much ahead of you. And, you know, so there was this positivity that I always felt. I never felt, well, there were times, I can't say I never felt. I did feel despondent at certain times. There was times where I thought, oh, what's the purpose of living? You know, like, my joy is gone, my purpose is gone. And then I'm going, no, of course not, it hasn't. Mm. So I think that there was always this conversation. That's why this internal conversation was so important to me, because as soon as I'd go one direction, I would have that
alternate
balance,
thought.
That alternate balancing view that says, absolutely not, that's not true. Mm. So my default was always, what do I know to be true? Mm. That's what I clung to.
So it would seem that close to 50% of married people are going to find themselves at some point in their life, like you, that they had a partner and now they don't. So what if you were to give a piece of advice to someone who experiences or may experience someday an unexpected loss, what would be one or two things you would say to them? Okay, after the initial rush and the flurry of the crisis and the planning, what piece of advice might you give them?
Have a team. Have your team behind you. You're not alone, and I think that's really important. Have Have a few trusted friends that you know that are going to be there for you and will be able to put up with your rantings and ravings and your mood changes and help you make decisions. Just be a good listener. Be prepared to some degree. I think, my advice would be, before this happens, talk about death.
I see.
I think we're too afraid to talk about death. And to me, life and death, they go together. If we're not talking about death, we're not talking about life. So one of the biggest sort of obstacles I see for people is that they're scared to talk about it. They're scared to bring it up either with themselves or with family members. And I just think the more you talk about it, the more demystifying death and that transition becomes. And certainly if you have a faith in God and you have a faith in eternal life, death is not the end. And so you have a new hope. There's a whole different perspective on death. I had some counseling afterwards, and I think that's really critical. You need to sort of have a third party that doesn't know the situation really well, but has that good advice. One of the best pieces of advice I had from my counselor was, your grief is entirely your own. You cannot compare it to anyone else. Do not expect it to look a certain way. Just go through it. And don't judge others. You know, like, don't let others judge you or you judge others for how they're going through their grief, because it's entirely individual. And that was a huge comfort to know, okay, I'm not crazy because I'm thinking this or feeling that or responding in this weird way.
Okay. So what about on the other side? There's those that are going through a loss like that. There's lots of others who want to be of help and of good support. But there's that feeling of, well, who am I to jump in? Maybe I should give space. I don't know what to say. So what about someone who finds a friend or a family member going through something unexpected and tragic like this? What would you say to the person who wants to be a good help?
Just be real. Just say what's on your heart and cry with them, and don't say anything if you don't feel you can say anything. Don't just blurt something out because you feel you have to say something. Sometimes silence is good. And I had amazing people around me that just could listen. I had one or two people say kind of a little weird comments that I kind of brushed off. And I said, I'm not holding that against them that they said something a little off. That's their awkwardness, right? I felt sorry for them more than anything. I wanted to ease their discomfort by saying, don't worry about it. Let's just talk about this, And so my response, I think, was always about, let's get it all out in the open and just talk. Don't feel hidden agendas. You can't talk about this subject because that'll upset Gwen. Don't do that. Just be real. I think that's all you want. And so I really pushed into that a lot. I was very deliberate about being forward around, what is this I'm in? What is the situation here? What are we feeling? What are we doing individually, collectively, whatever? And let's talk about death. Let's just break this thing down, and not hold anything back. I think that, to me, was just more my personality, that's how I wanted to handle it. Some people might not want to do it that way.
Or might not be in as a healthy place to be able to step back from their own grief, to be able to go, okay, this is what's happening to me.
But I think, taking that question just a little bit further down the timeline, is that those are the first couple of years, maybe I'd say up to about 5 years, it's still a lot of decompressing and processing what happened. And also just dealing with the life you had. There's this line in the sand that's been drawn, and you had a life that was there, the previous life, and now you have this other life. And there's a huge transition in that process of not only closing down Rick's life, like I was his executor, so I was looking after all of the closure of his business, of his life, of all the things he opened up, his internet account, the bank accounts had to change, all our contact information had to change. And so that took 2 years to notify the right people. And so that there was a process involved in bringing Rick's life into a closure. And with that went so much of his passion and stuff was all kind of rolled into this ball. And so, you know, that takes time too to sort of process. His life's come to an end. Mm. And so what does that mean? And then this new life that you have, what does that mean? And I was in this kind of gray zone in between the two where it was, I didn't know which way I wanted to go. It's like, do I want to go backwards, which is remembering everything I had? Or do I move forward where I look to a new future and a new hope that God has prepared for me already? He prepared it before I was born. So why am I deliberating in this middle zone? I need to move forward. And so I was very consciously aware that I need to move forward, and that's so many healthy response to this. Rick would want that for me.
Right. Huh. Well, from my observation, Gwen, you're doing a good job. And it's inspiring. Here's thinking about moving forward into what's ahead. What about dating? Are you interested? And if not, why not?
Only you can ask me that question. Oh my goodness. My daughters have asked me that question, oddly enough. This is one of the harder questions to answer, because in the place I am now, no, I haven't dated. No, there's no one in my life. And I think part of it is I'm actually in the singleness of my life and embracing that. And so to think of another person entering in at this point is a little weird. I know it's possible, but I'm not seeking it. And I think when I look on that particular subject, I think, well, God provided Rick for me. I never sought Rick out. He, you know, like that was a God-given gift that he gave me, that relationship. So if God has a plan for my life, he will provide the right opportunity for me to be aware of that. Right now, no one has come forward in my life that I think this is it. You know, okay. I have to consider this. But I'm not closing the door. I'm absolutely open to whatever God has for me. But I don't want to let it be front and center. Of course, it's always there behind the scenes, because I miss being married. I miss companionship. I miss the intimacy of a friendship that I've got someone watching my back, you know, that constant, someone cares about what you did that day. I miss that a lot, but I it's not the only reason I'd want to be married, you know, or have another person in my life.
So I know we focused a lot on the loss side of losing someone. Is there anything, and maybe this is an odd question, is there anything about being single that you go, I like being single this way? Actually, there's some benefit. Is there any part of your life that you find you really enjoy that part of being single again?
Yeah, that's true. I do.
So what are those? What are
it
a few?
It took a while
things?
To come to it, but I think I like that I can do whatever I want, and I think my life was full of compromise and a happy compromise.
Right.
It wasn't difficult, but it was compromise nevertheless. It was, I always deferred to what others needed before myself. So this is my season of saying, no, Gwen.
This is what I want.
Hey. And I'm also discovering things about myself that I didn't know about, because I'm opening up the opportunity for me to explore that, right? That singleness has given me freedom to explore areas of my life that I hadn't done before. And that is just get up and go, spontaneity. And someone says, can you do this? And I'll say, yeah, I can. Because I've got no other, no one else to consider in that. It's only me. And so those kinds of decisions are easier. The harder decisions are the bigger decisions, the financial decisions, the long-term decisions, the coping decisions for, you know, how do I manage what I've got? That's my big worry is, okay, I've got property, I've got a house, I've got animals, I've got responsibilities. How do I keep this going? You know, how much longer can I keep this going the way it is? And so those are questions that I have that are my alone questions that I wished I had a partner with to say, hey, will you come alongside and help me with these decisions? So I miss that part.
I see.
Yeah.
If you would look at yourself, how you were in 2011 and now today, what would you say? What are the one or two biggest ways that you've changed? That you're, aside from the fact that Rick is not by your side, what's different about the Gwynne Butler of today?
I think I'm stronger. Hmm. I'm totally stronger. Hmm. And I'm stronger in my faith. I don't think I would have leaned on God as much as I have without Rick's death. Hmm. You know, like I would lean on Rick.
Yeah.
You know, he would be my go-to. So I think when you don't have that, God becomes so real to you. Hmm. He is your best friend. And I just think I can't imagine going through something like this and not having God on your side. Hmm. And so I think my faith has really been strengthened for sure. Hmm. Relationships with others, I feel freer in a freedom in really knowing that God is bringing into my life the right people. And it's just like this abandonment towards, well, what do you have for me today, God? Mm-hmm. You know, like it's an excitement for possibilities. And I know that every single person I meet, there's a reason I'm meeting them. Hmm. There's a reason they're there. That conversation was important. And so I've got this heightened awareness. It's like this hypersensitivity. I describe it as like putting on a new set of glasses, new lens with crisper, clearer vision. So I feel I've got that. And it's because I've come through, I think, this time.
Hmm. It's interesting that you use the word adventure, because when we started out talking about your adventure, travel, the North, experiencing the world, it was geographically related, and now you use that word adventure more in relational, exactly. You know, whatever is going on that day with people.
Yeah, interesting.
Hmm. You've talked a little bit about your faith and how that's your relationship with Jesus has made a difference in those moments. What about the church community, the faith community around you? Any way that being part of a Christian community has made a difference for you?
Huge, huge difference. It was the one single thing that I think made all the difference for me. And that's why I'm so committed to this church, because they are my family. They were my family at a time when I needed it the most. Mm. I was just so amazed at the people that came forward and how important it was that I had a church family. Hmm. And so when I look at how I'm volunteering in the church now, because I'm so ready to jump in and say, yes, I'll do that. Yes, I'll do that. Because they were there for me. Hmm. And if I can be there for that, you know, if I can be part of this body, I want to be contributing back. And so I can't imagine, again, going through a life-changing experience without not just family and friends, but this church family, this family of believers who are really understanding your heart in a way that's deeper, in a sense, because it's so faith-based, and really understanding that death and grief are intermingled with hope and joy, and you only have that hope and joy when you have Jesus, because you have eternal life. This continuum of life from predestination, God planned your life before you were born, and now there is more beyond this life that we know. And you can only share that with believers because they have that hope in eternal life.
Mm. Oh, thank you.
Can I just add one more thing?
Go ahead, yeah.
Jason, I have to say it. You were just such a blessing to me as a pastor, as a friend to both Rick and me. I just sing your praises, because I know that, you know, the comfort that you came with those days afterwards, you and Cindy together, and the way you've walked with me over these last years. I just feel so lucky, so blessed to have had a pastor like you.
Hmm. Well,
I'll throw that in there.
thank you. I those people who know me, I remember a few years before Rick's passing, another family who lost their son in an accident, and I remember the call that that his mom gave to me. It was still kind of unknown as the ambulance was taking him to the hospital, but they had just learned that he had died. And I remember her phoning me and me responding the best way I could. And I remember saying to her, "I'm so sorry. At the same time, you know me, and I'm not always the most emotive person on those things." And I said to her, "I wish I was a better pastor, and I care, and I want to serve you however I can. I wish I could respond." You compare yourself to how other pastors might respond in that moment. And she said to me, and it's been a real encouragement ever since, she said, "Jason, I knew you would respond in this circumstance the way you did, the way you are right now, kind of steady and calm, and that's why I called you, and it's okay." And it gave me some relief, because again, sometimes I feel I do have a pastor's heart, but not always the prototypical one that responds a certain way. And so I'm grateful that however God's made me up, it serves some people well anyways.
Yeah, no, it certainly served me well.
Mm-hmm. So Gwen, the mic is yours. Tell anything else you want to say, and tell us what's going on in your life right now. What are you doing as we speak? What's live in front of you right now in your life?
One day at a time. That's my motto.
Okay.
There's actually two mottos that I live by. One is one day at a time. So don't look too far down the road. As soon as I look too far down the road, I get anxious. So it's like, no, only just the next step. And do what you can with what you have. So I'd say what's in my heart now is service. I just feel everything that I have, everything that I own, everything that I am does not belong to me. It belongs to God. So I want to be of service. And so I know you've seen it in me, and I can't stop it. It's like this thing that was always there. I have to give. I have to be available and offer service to others. And that's my joy. So if I'm not doing that, I'm not happy. So if you come out to my place, I've got an acreage. I love it. I just love it when I see cars rolling in and someone's walking their dog, and another car rolls in and someone's riding my horse, and another car rolls in and it's someone who just wants to just be out in the country. And I'm just going, yes, 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 come. I want everyone to enjoy what I enjoy. And so for me, my sense of completeness comes when I see everything that I have and own and am being used to God's glory, right? It's for, because it's not mine, it's His. And so I think I just kind of trundle along with life. And right now I've got three part-time jobs, and every one of them I love. And they're just sort of, I've made that decision. I only do what I love. And I volunteer where I can, and just be open to the people that walk in and out of my life, and give them permission to walk out. You know, like, I don't have any hard feelings if something is working for a while and then no, it's not, and they're busy and they have to move on to something else. It's okay.
I remember a definition of hospitality that's been helpful for me. That hospitality is the welcome to come in at any time, but it's also the freedom to give people to go. It's not just the receiving, but it's also not putting guilt on when people need to step away.
Yeah.
One question. I know trees were a big part of Rick's life, your property. I know that it was also planting that spring following the funeral. There was a big tree planting party. How are the trees, and what do they mean to you as you watch them grow? I know things grow slowly in this part of the world. But to tell us about the trees.
Trees are amazing. Hmm. And you're right, the trees are my markers. Oh, every time I walk on the land, I just see the trees. And I say to Rick, you'd love to see the trees. Look how big they are. And yeah, there's a certain stage with the trees. They grow really slowly. And then all of a sudden, they take off. Hmm. And so now they've doubled in size since Rick passed away. That's almost 8 years now. Hmm. And so I love the trees. They are his gift back to me and to this world, right? He'd loved those trees as well. And so, yeah, they're very symbolic, the trees. There's one tree outside my kitchen window that I call Rick's tree.
Okay.
And it's a big, lovely spruce. But there's something very special about this spruce tree because it was planted the first year we moved into that house. It's over 20 years now. And it went through a really sick stage where it was anemic. It was like lime green. And it had been deprived of water for a couple of years because we were away and it was a drought those 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so we came back and there were only out of 30 trees planted, only two survived. So this was one of the survivors. And so I nurtured this tree and I watered it and I sprayed its needles and gradually it started to change color back to brilliant green, that lovely deep green. And I've watched it grow outside my kitchen window, and it's where the birds perch in, and I love the birds. And it's grown threefold since that time. And I call it Rick's tree because it's straight and tall, and it's perfect. And we've actually even put some of his ashes up around the base of the tree. Mm. Yeah, these trees are amazing. Huh. Yeah, love them.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing, and maybe that tree is a bit of an analogy for your life, for ours. It's not like we have a straight line. We go from growth to growth to growth. There are seasons of
drought
and hard times, but by God's grace, we can make her through and even come out more beautiful on the other side. So, Gwen, I just, again, want to say thank you for your inspiration to us as a community, to me as a person. I know lots of people who've been widowed, and you're always, again, one of the first people that comes to mind in a person who's navigating life with class, with dignity, with style, and with, as what's come out in our chat here, just always an eye for others. And so as much as I can, I just want to say keep going. And thank you so much for being open and vulnerable in front of a mic like this.
Well, thank you so much for asking me. I wouldn't have talked about it otherwise.
Okay. Well, you're now go down as the first guest ever. Oh. You go down. So it's been an inspiration and a joy to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Real Podcast. For more information on this episode and others, check out our website at CochraneAlliance.com/real. Until next time, keep it real.